Now, I've never met a man that didn't think he was moral, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks they're moral.
Yeah.
But the problem is we make exceptions. Oh, except for this one deal where I had to cheat to get this contract, mm-hmm. or when I had to pay this bribe to get mm-hmm. the politician to do this law, or when I had to put the best interest of me ahead of my family or community or the country. Those things are going on out there. But I've been very blessed. Most people I deal with are moral people and deal with me in a moral way.
My name is Matt Bros with Lockton, and I have been so fortunate in my life to be surrounded by some really awesome people. So I want to be able to get their stories out there so that we can all learn from them together. Welcome to the Excellence Culture. Welcome to Excellence Culture. Again, my name is Matt Brost, and I'm really excited about the conversation I'm going to have today with Dory Wiley, who's the president and CEO of Commerce Street Holdings. For me, I mean, I know that this conversation is going to be some neat personal stuff. It's going to be some great kind of market insight stuff. He's even got this affinity just for history, so I know we're going to get into that. So, Dory, I really appreciate you spending time with me today.
You bet, Matt. Glad to be here. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. I first was introduced to you at an FEI event that you were the keynote speaker at. And everybody was talking about, like, Matt, you've got to come to this FEI, Dory Wiley speaking. And I wasn't introduced to you yet. And now I can see why, because you just there was something about, you know, your presence up there and also just the content of what you were saying. It was just really, really a very good presentation. So thank you for that time, too.
Well, you're very kind to say so. Thank you. I'm humbled by that.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, a lot of times when we're on the Excellence Culture, we kind of go past, present, future. And I really want to kind of hear about you. It's mainly about your story. No real, like, agenda here or anything like that. But I just kind of want to hear a little bit about how you brought up and what made you you. And so can we kind of backtrack and think about little Dory as a kid and, you know, where you grew up, what the family dynamics were, and even some of the values that you were taught?
Sure. I'm a seventh generation Texan, grew up in West Texas. Don't let the New York accent throw you off. A little town called Rawls, just outside of Lubbock. Rawls Jackrabbits, fighting jackrabbits, really tough mascot.
Does that have to do with the Rawls school?
No, that's a different Rawls. This is the poor Rawls. That was the expensive Rawls. This is R-A-L-L-S, little farming community, cotton farming community outside of Lubbock. My dad started out as a football coach and then sold insurance mostly to farmers. And I grew up working on the farm, started in the fourth grade and worked ever since. And, you know, you get a work ethic in small towns. Yeah. You deal a lot with people in your community. You get a lot of value system based around helping each other out no matter what's going on, sort of like the fire and the pail system. You know, everybody helps each other no matter what's going on in the small community. It's about 1,800 people, 49 in my graduating class. And I had three older sisters. Grew up in a 2,000-square-foot house and then went to Texas Tech, which seemed like a really big city in Lubbock. I was very excited about that. Got a finance accounting degree and left and came to Dallas.
And if you can tell, you've got a voice that I would call a radio voice. So you had some time in radio, right?
I did while I was in school. It didn't start out with a radio voice. They almost fired me, so I had to change it at the time. Maybe I grew into it. But, there was a college radio station, KTXT. So, you know, they had a little tag, you're all the way to the left at KTXT 88.1. So anyway, that was a fun time. I did radio.
Was it music?
It was music. And I wound up enjoying doing club more than that.
Oh, really?
And I had six guys working for me, and we did all the fraternities, sorority parties, high school parties, whatnot.
So mixing and...
All the mixing, and I can still do it.
I
still have about 11,000 records, and I enjoyed that a lot.
Okay, so I'm noticing when I go to, you know, stores, I mean, you're starting to see records come back in style. And we just, you know, Taylor Swift's album just came out, and that's a whole nother subject. But
You went and bought one, didn't you?
No, I didn't. But I did listen to it because I want to know what my kids are going to be listening to.
Sure.
And, you know, she's obviously incredibly talented. But she's taking some liberties now that I don't know if I want my kids listening to. So we'll see. But her record is in the stores. Like, they've actually got the vinyl. $50 for the vinyl.
$50.
$50.
That's amazing.
Like, I even saw one that was $75. And then I was at Barnes & Noble the other day, and they've got a whole section of vinyls now. And the cheapest one I could find was $50.
Yeah, there were $4 to $8 when I did my collection. And if you bought rare 12-inch dance mixes, that might get into $12 to $15, $20, unless it was, you know, extremely rare.
Yeah. And are you blending kind of the records, the music together?
Yes, beat mix and scratch and all that kind of stuff. Kind of like David Solomon of Goldman Sachs, you know, he got to come out of the closet and be a DJ, even though I think he gets some grief for it. So it let me kind of go, hey, I was a DJ once, rather than kind of hide the past.
Yeah. Well, I think that's cool. It seems like you've got some hobbies in your life that you appreciate, and we're going to be able to get into one of those later too. I've had, I think, over 20 of these conversations, and I believe I've had 5 now of people who grew up on a farm. Wow. Of the 20, which is, you would think that's unique, but I mean, they're really impressive leaders. And I would say that a lot of that has to do with that upbringing. And so I'd love to, you know, can you think of just some kind of random story as a kid of some of your memory of growing up on a farm and maybe something that came out of that? Like, just,
well, I know this, you know, when you get up and you're out in the hot sun and you're hoeing cotton all day, your goal is to do something else.
Yeah.
What's the next step? Maybe I can get into a tractor and drive a while. Yeah. But the job that I coveted that I never got was, I wanted to be the guy in the pickup at the end of the turn row with the window rolled down, making sure everybody else was working. And that was my goal in life. I want his job because that looks a whole lot better than what I'm doing out here.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but it was, I always thought it was good work. You know, I think I started out at 50 cents an hour, got to $1 an hour, got up to $2, $2.50 an hour, and that was big money for me. We used all our money to pay for really necessities. My parents were very, you know, you're going to take all that money, save it up, and you'll buy school clothes at the end of the summer.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't to go buy, you know, extracurricular stuff. You know, it was used to contribute to the family. Most everybody I knew was that way.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it seems like that doesn't even exist anymore. You know, I think, I know, you know, I wish that was the case for my kids, but I know that if they get the opportunity to make some extra money, getting them to think about saving that money just is so distant. Like,
it's difficult. We had this conversation in the morning with a couple of friends that grew up in a small town. And I think it's a function of a few things. One is, and my wife pointed this out to me. She said, you know, you came from a little bitty house in a small town. Your goal is to get the big city and big house. You're here. Your kids already have that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they don't have to have a work ethic because they're here.
Yeah.
So how do you give a work ethic to get something better than when they look out, you know, can they afford a house?
Yeah.
You know, they're in their upper 20s.
Yeah.
You know, I made the same amount of money or more than my kids in the late 20s. My first house cost $60,000. Mm-hmm. You know, first house nowadays, what is that, $400,000, $500,000?
Yeah.
It, the math doesn't work like it used to. Yeah. And so there's a little less incentive. Maybe harder to instill the work ethic. And then when you reach back where we come from, you know, my grandparents come out of the Great Depression. You know, my parents are very attached to that. There was never money wasted, even if you had it.
Yeah.
There was never extra, you know, we didn't go out all the time, didn't do all these things. We wore hand-me-downs. Sometimes we shopped at garage sales and things like that.
Yeah.
I don't know anyone that really does that now with their kids.
Yeah, and I don't think it's just because we're in some special circle or anything like that. Mm-mm. Too. I think
the standard of living across everywhere, from poor to middle class and upper, has all risen up.
Yeah.
And once you're further away from that depression and realizing what happened, your propensity to save for that rainy, dark day decreases because you you've never experienced one. Your parent, you know, we haven't been through a depression. We've been through 2008 hard times, or the 80s were kind of hard times, but nothing, nothing close to what the depression was like.
Well, that makes me almost want to start going into talking about the market, but I don't want to do that yet because I want to be able to obviously fast forward your time in college. You were studying finance, right?
I studied finance and accounting.
Okay.
I had low self-esteem, so I got a CPA, CFA, CVA, and every securities license you can imagine. Last I checked, I was the most licensed security guy in the state. And just, you know, insecure, I guess. But anyway, that's...
I doubt
that's
that.
And then I went to SMU grad school as well.
Okay.
MBA.
Gotcha. Okay. And so what was your first kind of job outside of once you got out of school?
So the market crash happened in October of 1987, right? And I graduated with that dual degree in December. So I had an offer, but it got pulled because of the crash. So I couldn't get into the finance sector, which is where I wanted. I had been an electrical engineering major and switched majors, so I became a tax software programmer for a year and then was able to move over, and I did not enjoy that. But I had had a couple of internships in tax, so that helped. Then I was able to move that over into a savings and loan risk portfolio manager type position, you know, dealing with asset liability management, securities management, things like that. And then a headhunter found me a year later and recruited me to go to Rauscher Pierce Roughness, which at that time was the largest broker-dealer investment bank in the South, based here in Dallas. And that's where I wanted to go to begin with. So that was divine intervention, luck, whatever you want to call it. Very fortunate. To go there, and I stayed there 7 years. Left as the head of the financial institutions group. They put me through SMU as well. And then joined a couple of guys over at a firm called Service Asset Management and became partners for the next 27 years.
And which is now Commerce Street.
Now Commerce Street Holdings, correct. One of the partners passed away. So there's two of us.
Yeah, so when we were talking prior to this, you know, Commerce Street Holdings is obviously known for the investment banking side of banks. But I would love to kind of hear, it sounds like you guys do a lot more than that. And I think it's good if everybody kind of knows that.
So, thank you. Banks are our mainstay. We've been the number one investment bank to banks in Texas and the Southwest for 27 years, top 10 in the country. But we do energy, we do real estate, healthcare, manufacturing, technology, fintech. We do third-party marketing of alternative assets. We operate almost like a merchant bank. We also invest as principals. We do sponsored equity. We're the fastest-growing 401k provider in the state. We do outsourced chief investment officer business. We run private equity funds, private equity fund-of-funds, hedge funds, and private credit fund-of-funds. And there's probably something else I forgot to mention, but we dabble in structured finance and a couple other things as well. So we do a lot of things for, you know, we only have 50 employees. But nowadays, that puts us, I think, as maybe the largest investment bank in Dallas, independent.
I mean, you're a powerhouse here. And the amount that you all do, it's really surprising to hear that you do that with 50 employees. And so, you know, is that just part of the culture of being at Commerce Street? Is that, you know, we get people with a pretty high engine in here to be able to wear multiple hats? Or
we do. It's a little different model than the rest of the investment. We're a very flat organization. Everybody produces. And the deadwood doesn't stay around long. You know, it's very incentive based, and you have to be high energy, self motivated. And want to make a bunch of money, but at the same time, do the right thing. And the way we're structured is for, even if we're doing a transaction, it's about relationships and reputation. That's more important to us. Because that's what gets us more business.
Well, you have an unbelievable reputation.
So. You're very kind to say that. Thank you.
Yeah, very good job. Well, let's get, let's kind of, you know, my introduction to you is doing the market update at FEI. And so, you know, right now we're in an election year. And it feels like just a lot of things around pause. I'd love to just kind of hear your thoughts around just the overall, you know, economy of the U.S. and like we can even go global. And not to say that any of us are going to be making bets on what you're saying, but I would.
I wouldn't.
But I really want to know your thoughts because it's probably the most educated, you know, opinion that I have in my life. And so I'd love for you to be able to kind of share that a little bit with
us. Sure. Let's start with the Fed and then we can talk about different sectors. Everyone wants to know what the Fed's going to do with rates. It seems to drive everything, and as well as the expectations of those rates. You know, the market has been expecting the Fed to lower rates for over 20 months now. And, you know, with the inverted yield curve, and it hadn't happened. I don't think there's been a fundamental reason to justify lowering rates. Mm-hmm. Some people are mad about that. They want them to lower rates because they think it's the Fed's job to lower rates and make everything rosy. But they don't understand they're fighting inflation. You know, inflation peaked up at 9%, and it's come down. And every time in history that it's done that, it's gone back up again. So if we stay the same, or lower rates, or even stay the same, we're still at risk for inflation, you know, coming back up. Everyone sees it in their bills. Everyone sees it in cars. Everyone sees it in their homes. Everyone sees it in their food and their restaurants. Mm-hmm. It's pretty, you know, very few people that I know, even if they're of means, eat out as much as they used to.
Yeah.
And that's never, ever going down again. Yeah. Inflation is about the rate of change going up, not about it going down. And so there's much more likely that it's going to go up. It's just at what rate?
Yeah.
Or will go up. It's the question is what rate. I'm hoping that they don't lower rates this year, and I'm hoping they don't have to raise rates. And there's not a lot of talk about that.
Yeah.
I do think it's an election year. I interviewed one of the Fed governors in a conference about this. There seems to be some division that's developing. Perhaps it's political. I got the impression from one of the Fed governors that it was political for Powell, who has been very apolitical since he was confirmed by the Senate and very explicit about what he's going to do, even if the market didn't listen to him, except for two times. In December, he was very dovish, you know, talked about lowering rates, and the market got excited and rallied and forecast that there were going to be seven cuts the next year.
Yeah.
Way ahead of itself. And then you spent the next week or two with the other Fed governors talking that back and being hawkish. He did it again in March. So I would not be surprised if there is a rate. I think it is because I think there's some division. Yeah. So I think that if there is a rate cut this year, which I don't expect there one to be in June, but if there is one towards the latter half of the year or even two, I think they're purely political unless some numbers come out that we don't expect.
Well, I mean, the president shouldn't have influence over the Fed, right? Like, isn't that the way it's set up?
But it's about being appointed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Trump's already come out, and he probably shouldn't have done this, come out and said he would get rid of Powell. So, you know, there's a bias. You know you're getting fired. Can you still be independent?
Yeah. Yeah. And is that a little bit from Trump saying, like, my plan is to be able to impact the rates with this new appointment?
Well, you know, that's a good point. It works both ways, right? You can't say I'm going to go out and fire this guy. You know, he'd be much better off evaluating whether they've done a pretty good job. I'm pretty honest with you. They've done a pretty good job.
Yeah.
We've had a soft landing. The economy's growing.
Yeah.
There's no reason to cut rates. In the banking sector, for example, I was on CNBC recently, and they were like, well, the market is pricing banks at very low values because they think they can't make money unless there are lower rates, and that's just not true. They just don't need them to go up 500 basis points again. It's pretty tough to deal with that kind of net interest margin compression.
Yeah,
they're fine. All their assets and liabilities pretty much mature on the short end, so that'll work out. So it's created a lot of buying opportunities on the bank side, but this perception that the market, that rates have to go down in order for the market to do good, it's kind of contradictory because if we have to lower rates, that means the market and the economy is doing bad.
Yeah. It's probably just a reflection of that. Our memory is still, it's very a close, it's a close memory of those 2-3% interest rates, right? Like,
absolutely. Not that far, you know, I had this this discussion with a CFO and a CEO of a bank in South Carolina, where the new CFO is really, really good, but he wants to run the bank at a very high loan to deposit ratio, which means, you know, more lent up, less liquidity, because that's what he's used to seeing in the last 10 years. Because if you had the money in bonds, you didn't make a spread. The bonds were yielding less than what deposits cost. Mm-hmm. So that's all he's ever seen, because he's 40 years old or 42 years old. But if you're pre-2008 for the previous 50 years, you're a normal loan-to-deposit ratio that's probably 75 to 80%, which would work very well in this environment, because you can make a spread even on cash now at 5% over deposits that are costing 2 or 3%.
Yeah.
We're just not used to see it. So it's a function of perspective.
Well, I'm waiting to refinance my house, but I think you gave me less hope.
Yeah, I apologize for that.
No, it's okay. It's reality.
There's a case there's a lot of layoffs in the tech industry.
Yeah.
That people really aren't talking about. And the Fed, to a man or woman on the board, or a couple of them, they don't trust the data that's coming out. They've been very public about that. But that unemployment rate keeps going up, and inflation at least is staying in check or a little down, they might try to lower rates.
Yeah.
But
could be bit justified, but
yeah, that's where you could justify it.
Yeah. And recently, I know on the news recently, Tesla's been on there a lot. I mean, there's a lot going on with Tesla. Any thoughts around?
Yeah, I avoid Tesla because it's been a cult stock. I'm a big fan of Elon Musk.
Yeah.
I mean, he's an amazing individual.
He's a genius.
He put out a book recently. I don't know if you've read it or listened to the book on tape. If you get a chance to do it, it's an amazing success story. He came from a tough home and rose up, and he's super bright and extremely over the charts, type A driven. Mm-hmm. And I hope he succeeds. I mean, with whatever he does. But the problem is his stock doesn't trade on any fundamental kind of valuations.
Yeah.
And some might say, well, all the Magnificent Seven are that way. No, that's not true. I mean, NVIDIA, you know, has a 51% margin in coins money, literally just coins money like we've never seen in any stock. And it warrants a big multiple.
Yeah.
And big price, because it's fundamentally, Tesla doesn't have that.
Yeah. Let's stick on the market side. You know, oil and gas is certainly in a good place right now. I just saw on the news this morning that there's some places in the country where people are paying over $7 a gallon for gas. And so what are your thoughts around oil and gas? I know you guys are participating in it a little bit.
Yeah, you know, it's oil and gas is mystical.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
yeah.
Probably one of the hardest things to forecast. You know, structurally, fundamentally, on the supply side, you know, that market's struggled for a while now, and there hasn't been capital there. Mm-hmm. So all that lends to a higher price at some point, whether that be today or 3 years down the line. But oil tends to trade on a little bit shorter valuation. You know, oh, China wants less, or are we in a recession? Are we not? And less on those long-term fundamental supply numbers. I think there's a lot of long-term fundamental supply numbers that justify $80 to $120 barrel oil over the long term. Over the short term, you know, it's just kind of hard to say. We're the largest producer, 12 million barrels a day. Russia's second now at 10 million, and that's iffy, right? You know, who's going to buy their oil? What's going on politically, et cetera? It certainly gives it, with their war going on, and that's really their only source of income, that gives them the justification to keep at war rather than back off.
Yeah.
But I think if we can keep our production up and keep oil at 80, that would be good and good for the economy all around. Once it starts to get to 100, 120, it's a drag. It's inflationary. It's kind of tough.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts around, you know, our reliance on oil and just how that intersects with the electric vehicle kind of side of things? And it feels like we talk about it a lot in the States, right? But is China talking about this as much as we do? Because obviously,
well, they do because they have no oil.
From the climate side.
Yeah, they're like the China of Japan of World War II. They have to get their oil from everywhere else because they don't have any. Yeah. And so they're probably more concerned about it than we are. Yeah. You know, we spend more oil building, you know, windmills and repairing them and electric vehicles than people can imagine. You know, the strip mining for nickel and all the stuff that needed for electric, you know, the whole green thing is a little bit of a misnomer.
Yeah.
And I don't know that the general public really gets that and understands that. A lot of what happens to us is self-inflicted. I mean, you know, what we fail to recognize is energy, this gets political, but energy independence determines our foreign policy more than anything else that we have. It's not defense. It's energy, because that's what the wars wind up being about. And so the more energy independent we are, the more we're expert in oil, exporting natural gas, I think that's good for the U.S.
Yeah, yeah. What are some other kind of, what do you think that we as just kind of consumers, as U.S. citizens, we need to be focused on related to the market right now and be paying attention?
I think the market, and there's certainly no guarantee, but during an election year, it started off with a bang, and now it's kind of fallen off. And as we drift into May, there's the old sell in May and go away. Yeah. Then you got the election in the fall. I don't think the market's going to do anything but just bounce around the rest of the year. So there's probably nowhere to hide. It is a stock market. Stock pickers market, there's plenty of value in there amongst the banks, not all of them, amongst technology firms, not all of them, amongst small cap, but not all of them. A third of them don't make money. A lot of them are overlevered. So normally, you know, I'm a big advocate of exposure through indices, and I still advocate that unless somebody wants to do the work. But active managers should be able to do pretty well over the next 24 months.
Yeah.
Because there is a lot of value out there right now, and it's going to stay choppy. If you look at the S&P earnings, everybody thinks they're positive. Not really. Take out four of the Magnificent Seven, and the earnings are negative.
Yeah.
Negative growth. So there's no justification for continued multiple expansion.
Yeah.
You know, in the S&P 500, the stock market hadn't realized that yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, about a year ago, we had maybe a little bit more than a year ago when we had another kind of banking scare.
Call that March Madness of 2023.
Yeah. No doubt. And I know you've got a pretty good feel of everything that's going on in the banking world. So, you know, where are we there? Is there still a threat in front of us? Or are we kind of in a landing spot right now that we can breathe? Or
yeah, that's a great question. You know, we had, we'll call it four failures, technically three, of banks, but none of those were credit issues. Mm-hmm. All of those were asset liability related or too long of assets, interest rate risk matched with deposit runs. And this is what no one talks about. All those banks were very leveraged at 5% tangible capital ratios. Most banks have more leverage than that. Most banks are not mismatching their asset liabilities. So, and they've had a year to kind of adjust that and deal with it. Now, there's a few that still have some trouble, but they'll work their way out of it as long as they have plenty of capital and there's not a deposit run.
Yeah.
Now, deposit run is partly determined by administration. I've been very critical of the Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, because she didn't step up to the mic and say, hey, your deposits are safe.
Yeah.
If we fail a bank, we'll move your deposits, insured or uninsured, to another bank, and they're okay. That's the way we've done it since 1934 with the FDIC legislation and the insurance, and that's how we'll continue to do it. She never said that. Mm. Instead, she got up to the mic and said, we may change what's insured and what's not. All that does is create instability, and that instability is still there. Mm. But, you know, for now, we're okay. The question is, what does she say when it comes up again? And then the last issue is credit. People are worried about credit. People are worried about real estate. They're worried about commercial real estate, specifically office space. Now, the big banks are pointing to the smaller banks. The small banks are pointing to the big banks. The banking industry is pointing to CDOs and structured finance. And we're all out here wondering, well, where are the problems? Mm-hmm. Now, we can see them. We have business buildings in Dallas and office mm-hmm. that are 40% occupied, 50% occupied. When does that come to roost?
Mm-hmm.
We know this. The banking industry has more capital than 08. It has less leverage than 08. The underwriting is much better than 08. And the problems, as bad as they were near as bad as what they forecasted. I don't think there's going to be a wave of real estate problems unless rates move up more.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's, there's some assurance there, but like you said, you're not the gospel, right?
So right.
We'll see.
Yeah.
How about healthcare? Obviously I have my job involves a lot related to healthcare. And with a political season and the Affordable Care Act, maybe something could happen with that. From an insurance side, you know, that matters. But then I know that you're on the provider side a lot and you're seeing the provider side of healthcare. Just love to hear your thoughts around healthcare. And
yeah. Well, you're going to know more about it than I would, yeah. You know, so I'll turn around and interview you. But I will say this. There seems to be a lot of pressures around healthcare and the system and insurance and, you know, what do we spend 90% of the healthcare in our life in the last 9 months of our life?
Mm-hmm.
There's real questions that have developed about that. And
yeah.
I don't know what the answer is. And I don't know what the moral answer is, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It probably depends on the person. And I know people have to work harder to get the healthcare that they want.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mother, for example, we were at one hospital. They picked her up. She had some, congestive heart failure issues. Ambulance took her to one hospital, and they said, well, you know, you're 82. You've got a valve problem. We can fix the congestive heart failure and put you on medicine, but, you know, your days are numbered.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, that doesn't sound right. Called two or three other hospitals up. We'll go over. I'm on the Healthcare Foundation, you know, Baylor. We'll go over there. They're like, oh, yeah, well, we can fix that. We've got a little robotic thing. We don't have to cut her open. And they go in there and look at it. Oh, looks like you need a triple bypass. So we'll do stents first, and then we'll do. Anyway, she's fine.
Yeah.
So one place you're dead, one place you're not, you know. Happens a lot. It's confusing, and
you don't really know if your best interests are being considered, you know.
And when you talk about someone from my mother's generation,
yeah.
they just do what the doctor tells them.
Yeah.
And you know, it's only maybe our generation or even younger where they question.
Yeah.
You know,
there's so much money involved, and I do think that these doctors, they do seem to have everyone's best interest in mind. Sometimes the systems don't. I think, you know, we're in the seat of sometimes helping an employer steward what they're doing in a fully insured model and steward what they're doing in a self-funded model. And in a self-funded model, you do a lot of cost containment and ways to help these patients still get healed, but in the most affordable way possible for everybody's best interest, even their best interest, so they're not paying more money next year for their insurance, right? And you know, really, what I just kind of see is we just need this push for providers to be able to have the insight of the cost containment things that employers are doing, because that's where sometimes it just goes crazy. Is that the providers are doing everything they can to heal, but they have no idea around what are the affordable ways to solve the same thing.
Who's got the whole picture involved? Yeah, and you have to hire a specific doctor to do that. I'll tell you something else I've kind of had an issue with, and I'll ask you to, I'll tell it as a question to you to get your feedback. You know, in my business, we're a fiduciary when we manage money, whether that be in a private equity fund, or I was on the board of Teacher Retirement System, $150 billion fund, and have fiduciary duty to that fund. You couldn't buy me a Coke if you were trying to market to the fund. You couldn't take me to lunch. You couldn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. You know, I wish our people up in Congress had to live up to that.
Yeah, right.
You know, anything kind of goes up on the Hill. But I've noticed in doctor land, when people are marketing medical products or procedures or drugs, the salespeople, you know, I want tickets to the U.S. Open. I want this. I want that. Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, well, wait a minute. Isn't there a kind of fiduciary duty that a doctor owes to his patient versus who? And he may be doing the right thing, right? Because I'm being very accusatory here. But it is an appearance of at least a conflict. You know?
Yeah, it's very.
We certainly don't.
Yeah, there's
in the finance business, it's pretty strict.
Yeah.
And there's strict laws on that. Why don't we have that in healthcare where a life is involved?
I actually think that there is regulation around that. But I don't know how well it, just like, you know, the roofing business and roofers aren't supposed to be helping people with their deductible, but they do, you know, but I do believe that there is regulation around that. And I do believe that there's not supposed to be that incentive. Because it's so easy to prescribe a prescription, right?
It's so easy.
And for the wrong reasons. That's not probably a side that we get too involved in. We're trying to take the mess and, like, say from an employer standpoint, this is what you can do about it. But yeah, I mean, if that regulation is as tight as it should be, we just need follow through.
Yeah, enforcement, I guess.
Yeah, enforcement. Yeah, yeah. Any other things from a market standpoint that we need to be paying attention to?
No, I think there's, you know, what's the market for IPO? A lot of people say, well, the market's too overvalued. I don't think that either. I think it does have some room to run. In an overvalued market, there are a lot of excessive, ridiculous IPOs. Yeah. We're not having a lot of that. You know, Reddit came public recently, a couple others. But there's not a lot of crazy stuff going on. We also have a lot of excessive, high-volume, high-priced M&A deals.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have that either.
Yeah.
You know, there's no AOL, Time Warner, or anything like that. So there's room to grow, and there's still plenty of money out there tied up in private credit and private equity that is now actually getting pretty active. So our business is actually picking up in the deal business of buyers and sellers because of that.
Yeah. So have you heard about the recent transaction with Dude Perfect and the capital that they just?
I don't think so.
So Dude Perfect is a social media, you know, YouTube channel. And they just got $100 million in capital and from the Hobby Lobby family.
Oh, okay.
And which is really interesting. You know, I think it's one of the first times where this massive world of social media influencers and YouTube influencers were able to justifiably capitalize on it. And so I'm just wondering if in your world, if that's on, you know, on anybody's kind of, you know, horizon to be looking at those kind of opportunities.
We look at all of them, you know, whatever kind of comes through the door. I had someone visit with me yesterday that was looking for have to be careful what I say, but it's a streaming service for a particular target market. I'm raising a bunch of money for that.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Cool. Cool. Well, I know that you've got another huge passion in your life, and that's history and that's research. And I'd love to hear, you know, just to kind of introduce it. I know that about a year ago, you went on kind of a tour of some sorts of just kind of, you know, giving a presentation about JFK and maybe the truth behind it. But I'd love to first hear, you know, where this desire grew in your life to just kind of know the truth. And I think you shared earlier just kind of justice, but high justice individual. Kind of tell me a story around that.
Yeah, I thank you. I love talking about history because we're learning about ourselves. I always tell people, everyone loves history. Mm-hmm. And they may not think so, but maybe they haven't had their approach right. Because history is just a study of human behavior.
When I was in school, for some reason, I didn't see history the way that I do now.
Yeah,
it almost takes some maturity to happen for people to truly realize.
Perspective, maybe.
Yeah. Perspective.
Because, you know, it seems the same. While we may have increased technology and science and this, that, and the other, our basic behaviors have not changed.
Yeah.
And the only way to learn from that is to study history.
Yeah.
Because by the time you figure it out, we're all old and dead, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the only cheat sheet you have is history, because everything is kind of really already been through. There was a movie that Steven Spielberg did called Amistad, and John Quincy Adams trying this case on the slaves in front of the Supreme Court. It's a wonderful case. But he's making reference to the Declaration of Independence and, you know, as a slaveholding country, you know, he goes, we have to go back to the Declaration of Independence to figure out who we are, mm-hmm. because who we are is who we were. Mm-hmm. And that always stuck with me. Who are you today? Well, you're a function of your parents and your ancestors and the environment and the municipalities you were in and those people and the history of that and the history of Texas and the history of the United States. All of that has had an influence on who Matt is.
Mm-hmm.
And how could I not be fascinated by that?
Yeah, I love it. And so you had this, how much research and how much time went into just kind of that presentation that you were doing around JFK?
On JFK, more than I'd planned on, because I've been a researcher for 35 years since I was a kid, or actually longer than that, I guess closer to almost 50 years now.
Yeah.
It started in the mid-70s when I was a kid. Sometimes you're more passionate about it than others. When I had Rugrats running around the house, you don't have a lot of free time to research JFK.
Yeah.
but at the same time,
that's where I'm at right now.
That passion started with an offense. I'm offended that somebody shot our president.
Yeah.
No matter what you think of the president, that I'm offended. This is the greatest country ever in the history of man. And who does that? Who has the gall to do that? And so it started out as kind of just being fascinated with that. And then the more I dug in, the more I learned about it, the more it became a black hole. And it incorporated almost anything you could ever be interested in, whether that be solving a crime, solving a murder, politics, spies and espionage. You could never write fiction like there is in what's involved in the JFK assassination. And the things that, you know, we'd be here for weeks.
Yeah.
And I could keep you, if you're interested in that topic, keep you engrossed in it.
And
then it'll ruin your life because then you'll go study it. I always tell people, be careful about getting too much into this. But it's fascinating. So it's really interesting.
Have you been able to, like, in this in-depth research that you do, have you been able to kind of back out and just get your head out of it for a little bit to go focus on your family?
Yeah, normally what I do, that's funny you should say, because it's not an uplifting subject unless you find that message, which I found that message.
Yeah.
But it took me years to find it, probably 30 years. What I would do is only study that from August through November 22nd.
Okay.
And then after that, I would study, you know, theology. I need something more uplifting, and American Revolution and other topics that I think are more uplifting, Declaration of Independence, whatever, because, you know, after those three. But once, over the last 5 years, once I've kind of found that uplifting message, it's been easier for me to do. But before, it was tough.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like Lord of the Rings. I love Lord of the Rings. You like that show?
Yeah.
But it's a dark deal.
Yeah, it is, yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But in the end, there is a good message in it.
Yeah.
It's just, God, there's a lot of darkness to wade through.
Is there much of a good message on JFK, though?
There is.
Okay.
Well, what it is, you know, we were in a time of Cold War. And I'll have to get into the assassination a little bit because that's part of the message. So just as a tiny bit of pulling back the covers here a little bit on the evidence side, there were some memos that came out over the last 20 years from the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And what we know now for a fact is that Joint Chiefs of Staff approached JFK and said, we need to nuke Russia before they nuke us. We need to start a nuclear war. And they all advocated it. And when you look at the background of those guys, they were all kind of warmongers, not in a bad sense necessarily, because they all came out of World War II. They helped save the world then. Mm-hmm. But that's how they're bred, right? We firebomb killed 300 plus thousand Japanese men, women, and children in Tokyo. Firebomb did the same thing in Germany. And we did those things to win a very brutal, ugly world war. I don't begrudge that. But that's the kind of people you had, and the guy they reported to was who? Their Supreme Commander, Dwight Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. Now who are they reporting to? Little rich kid, paid off the mob to get in, sleeps with everything that walks around, very amoral in their eyes. Mm-hmm. And also, they have problem with him and a track record of Bay of Pigs, Berlin crisis, this, that, and the other. So JFK opens a line of communication, but not through intel. It's his own with Gorbachev, or Khrushchev, excuse me, Khrushchev. And what they find out is Khrushchev has more control over his military intelligence complex than JFK does. Mm-hmm. And so it's Khrushchev that backs off it. The Cuban Missile Crisis, Khrushchev that backs off in the Berlin Crisis, Khrushchev who's crying the day that JFK gets shot. He's terrified of World War III because he knows that we want to start a war.
Yeah.
And he loses his job. JFK in his American University speech was pitching peace before the assassination. And it goes against everything that the Joint Chiefs of Staff wanted. The moral of the story, the good news is, he helped save the world from nuclear war. Mm. He was the first person to say, mutually assured destruction is stupid.
Yeah.
We need to reach out to these guys and have peace. So what we learn from that is there's a fine line between carrying the big stick from Teddy Roosevelt and world destruction that never existed before, you know, the Cold War. And it's and we walk that line now with what's going on in Russia or Iran or Israel. Things get out of control. You get a hothead or North Korea and they want to start a nuke. When is it, what stops that?
Yeah.
Right? So at the time, there were a lot of, Russia had their warmongers too, coming out of World War II. And I think the risk of you know, annihilation was very, very high then. Now it's pretty common to say mutually assured destruction is a stupid idea.
Yeah.
That never happened before JFK.
Yeah. Yeah, there would have to be somebody of just kind of pure ignorance and power.
Yeah. They, in defense of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, they really thought he was a communist. They really thought he was, his communication with Khrushchev was selling the country out.
Yeah.
They really thought he was anti-American.
Yeah. So I know you're doing now a lot of research on the Declaration of Independence, or you probably always have.
Right? I always have,
like just a love for it. And you were able to share some thoughts with me earlier of just going back to the Declaration of Independence and how important that is. I'd kind of love to hear you just kind of rehash a little bit of what we were talking about in the conference room.
Sure. One of my favorite classes is the signers of the Declaration of Independence and the meaning of the Declaration of Independence. This kind of gets back to who we are. And what we learn when we go back, without getting too much into the Declaration of Independence, is A, that's a very religious document. It's also sets us up with our Constitution to be a republic. And most people don't realize that today. We're a republic. We're not a democracy. Mm-hmm. And most people get on the news or whatever and say, hey, we need to save democracy. The founders hated democracy. They used to call it mobocracy. If the mob thinks murder is good, then murder is good. If the mob thinks crime is good, then the crime is good. So they called it mob because it just was the majority rule. Mm-hmm. There was a moral system in place mm-hmm. by the founders. And so it was a representative democratic republic. It was a republic, as Franklin said, a republic if you can keep it. And they tried to put a lot of checks and balances in it. So what that gets down to when you start studying it.
Define republic.
Yeah, a republic is representative republic based on some kind of sense of right and wrong.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
As it's defined.
Yeah.
How did the founders define it? Christianity.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people are offended by that. Oh, well, we can't have that. But they don't understand Christianity. Christianity is not a forced set religion. It's the only religion in history.
Because John Adams was atheist, wasn't he?
No.
He wasn't?
No.
Okay.
A lot of people like to say Thomas Jefferson was, but he wasn't.
Okay.
He wasn't. In fact, American Atheist Society uses a quote by Jefferson on their website that says, you should question the very existence of God.
Yeah.
But when you go back and look at the source of that, it was a letter to his nephew, Peter Carr, and it's seminary. It's apologetics.
Yeah.
You question the existence and you'll prove the existence
yeah.
of God. So people are always taking history out of context, which is a shame because historians do that
all
the time.
Well, it seemed like, though, that even those who maybe weren't Christian or didn't have a belief system, they still believed that this set of morals that was Christian morals was good for the country.
Like, absolutely. Yeah. So let's take Benjamin Franklin, who makes a great argument for this. And we're talking about a secular argument for a system of rules, right?
Mm-hmm.
Think about this. If we're going to set up a government today, we have to have a religion.
Mm-hmm.
That religion may be no religion. That religion may be in government. That religion may be in atheism or secularism or communism or Buddhism or what. But we have to have a religion.
Yeah.
We don't have a choice. Now, once people sit down and think about that,
you have to have a set of values.
You have to have a set. Where is it coming from?
Yeah.
And atheism is a religion.
Yeah.
You know, so is secular. So nothing is not possible. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And that's something that 99% of America haven't really sought down to think.
Mm-hmm.
And when they think about that, and then you go through the analysis, you'll go, well, now we know that there's a secular reason why they pick Christianity. As Ben Franklin said, if people are so bad with Christianity, imagine what they'd be like without it. Right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of the argument. You know, John Adams said, our Constitution was founded for a moral, religious people. It's wholly inadequate to any other. So when you go and look and see what's going on in D.C. today, no matter what side you are, it reminds me of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
There's a moral crisis going on. In fact, I forgot her name, the author that wrote the book on Lincoln. But she was talking about this the other day, too, and I 100% agree with her, that people are making up morals to defend their position.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no one in their right mind today would take a position that half the country did in 1860 that slavery is a good moral thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
People would much rather defend whatever they're doing with amoral argument
mm-hmm.
than admit they're wrong. And we have a lot of that going on today. So we have another moral crisis because we have this search for truth, or truth as I define it, versus what real truth is. And it's getting worse. And usually those lead to some kind of really big conflict. But what's interesting is everyone kind of recognizes that now. And so what I like to tell people when I'm visiting with them, I brought this up in that thing you attended to, is there's a tip of the hat of the virtue that whatever you do today, whatever you do with your family, if you're preaching right and wrong, if you're from a moral sense, if you're doing that in your job, if you're treating your employees that way, your customers that way, everyone, then you're doing your part, and eventually we will win with what's going on in D.C. Now, I've never met a man that didn't think he was moral, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody thinks they're moral.
Yeah.
But the problem is we make exceptions. Oh, except for this one deal, well, I had to cheat to get this contract. Mm-hmm. Or when I had to pay this bribe to get the politician to do this law. Or when I had to put the best interest of me ahead of my family or community or the country. Those things are going on out there. Mm-hmm. But I've been very blessed. Most people I deal with are moral people and deal with me in a moral way. I run into problems at times. Yeah. But most people are that way, and that gives me hope for America, because I think most people in general are good. It's the ones that get in power and get seduced by power that get corrupted, and they lose their way. They probably start out as moral people, and they probably tell you they're still moral. But it takes a really strong, wise, grounded person to look in the mirror and realize that they've been amoral.
Yeah. You know, and I love it.
The debt crisis we have today, that's a moral issue.
Yeah.
The we're broke on a lot of things. The way a lot of agencies and things are run, it's all a moral issue.
Yeah. No, just the virtue that you speak of, I just love it that is something that you were talking about, and I would assume that that's something that you're even talking about internally at your company. And so I really appreciate that. But from a political standpoint, and just I have a hard time believing that somebody who's not power hungry will decide to want to be president, because it just seems like you're losing your life if you are humble, if you are of virtue.
Do you want to be president?
No, I have zero interest.
I used to want to be president.
Like,
and I don't either.
Yeah. I mean, it'll ruin your family's life.
Yeah, and so that's the risk, right? And I think Dante said, you know, the lowest levels of hell are reserved for those people who remain silent and stand by and watch what goes on. Mm-hmm. And that haunts me, right? And we've had all those kind of warnings. You know, that's what happened in Germany. They had the majority, but they stood by and let the thugs take over. They never thought they were going to win. They never thought they were going to take over. And then it was too late. And that haunts me a lot. And so I think one of the things I found out in business is that we will get together and we'll talk about business, but we won't talk about virtues or morals or doing the right thing. We need to.
Yeah.
And I think once we bring that into the business place and into the family home and talk more about it, besides just church, I think it'll slowly creep up, you know, into D.C.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And I've been very fortunate. I didn't plan for this, but a lot of these conversations that I've had at this table have been just great conversations that you would probably expect only happen, you know, in home group or, you know, and so I've been really thankful for that. And it actually gives me hope to see all these leaders that come to the table and just, you know, talk about these real things that we all have this desire to just do the right thing. And I think, you know, it's good for us to be praying that at some point we're going to have somebody that has the courage to get in the middle of it, you know, for us from a political standpoint or a government standpoint, let's say. Any kind of last words that you would like to have, or anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about at all?
Well, that's pretty open-ended.
Yeah, it is.
I'll say this. I've enjoyed the conversation. I enjoyed being with you. Honored to be here. And appreciate the fact that you have this podcast to share messages that maybe some of them we don't talk about every day that need to be talked about. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, man. And welcome to the excellence culture. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Thanks.